Good morning, everyone, and thank you very much for joining us for this month's Tax Resolution Institute's Practitioners Forum. This is, again, a reminder, part of our Tax Tuesday series, and our Practitioners Forum happens every first Tuesday of the month. Our next call will be on May 1st, so please mark your calendars, May 1st. Hopefully, we'll all get a little bit of rest after the tax season. Before we get started, I want to remind everyone how these calls typically work. If you can hear the sound of my voice, then that means that you've logged in correctly. Because it can be difficult to moderate all the participants we have on today, we asked for questions to be submitted via email, and a lot of you responded. After we answer those questions and time permitting, we will open it up to the rest of you on the line. We will announce when the Q&A session has begun and ask that you please type in the questions box your name as you entered it while logging onto the call and that you have a question. We will then unmute you when we call upon you to ask your question. We will select participants in the order that you, when you submitted your name in the question box. Once we unmute you, you will be prompted by the system that you have been unmuted, and you will now be able to speak for all of us to hear. Now that we got that out of the way, let's go ahead and begin. Joining us on the call today, we have the head of our legal department at the Tax Resolution Institute, Mr. Norman Kreisman. Norman is an expert on Chapter 7, 11, and 13, debtor and creditor representation, while specializing in the discharging of federal and state taxes. Norman received his BS at the Arizona State University and received his JD at Loyola Law School. Norman has represented both debtors and creditors, has a history of successful execution, and helps to identify and clarify legal issues for his clients. A seminar speaker on discharging taxes in bankruptcy, he has been admitted to practice before the U.S. Tax Court and Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. As a leader of the Tax Resolution Institute legal team, Norman is an invaluable resource both for his ability to communicate effectively with clients and his extensive experience working with the IRS and state taxation agencies. Ladies and gentlemen, Norman Kreisman.
Good morning, everybody, and we want you to be sure to check out TRI's Tax Tuesdays, because each Tuesday, TRI offers something great. Today, the first Tuesday of the month, is Practitioner Call. As you know, this is a great opportunity to have your tax resolution questions answered at no cost to you. On the second and fourth Tuesday of each month, we offer Tax Tuesday lightning deals. Be sure to come back regularly as the offers change each time. Get free stuff, amazing discounts, and much more. And on the third Tuesday of each month, we broadcast our featured webinar. Learn audits, offers, installment agreements, appeals, and much more. If you forget what happens when, check out our course calendar at www.taxresolutioninstitute.org/courses. And remember, we're here to teach you how to make more money, work with you on your tax resolution cases, and become your trusted referral source.
Thank you very much, Norma, for that introduction. So now we're going to go ahead and jump right into the questions. Remember that members, VIP members, get priority on these calls. So the first series of questions here are going to be directly for members, and I'll give you a little bit of that, what it takes to become a member, a little bit later down the show or down the road. Okay, first one is from Brian. Brian is a CPA, and he has asked the question, I have a husband and wife who married in 2016. Husband has 2014 tax liabilities. How does the wife protect herself from IRS collections?
So it's a good question, because even though IRS is a federal agency and governed by a federal law, its collection is controlled by state law. And so which state you live in will determine how the IRS can collect the tax. So, for instance, here in California, it's a community property state. And so even if the husband owes taxes from the period before they were married, after they're married, the IRS can go after the wife's income to satisfy the husband's tax liability. So the question is how to protect the wife. So if you live in a community property state and you're getting married and you know that the person you're marrying owes taxes, do a prenuptial agreement. So a prenuptial agreement would make post-marital income separate property, and as separate property, it would protect it against collection from the IRS for the owing spouse's taxes. If they're already married and it's too late for a prenup, think about a postnuptial agreement. IRS does recognize postnuptial agreements. And again, that purpose of that would be to convert income, postmarital income, it would convert it from community property to separate property. So that's really the way to do it if you live in a community property state. And California is one of three states called 100%. And what that means is in some states, the IRS can only collect 50% of the non-owing spouse's community property, but in California, it's 100%. So if a couple got married and the owing spouse was unemployed or something, they could go after the non-owing spouse's income 100%. So it's really important if you know you're going to be marrying somebody with tax liability to think about a prenuptial agreement.
All right. Thank you very much, Norman, for that. Moving on to our next question is from Mary. Mary is also a subscriber, and she's an EA. Mary is asking, if a taxpayer has been assessed tax for 2014 but is now unemployed and considering filing for personal bankruptcy, will the taxpayer's tax debt be released in a personal bankruptcy?
So the answer could be yes, could be no. It depends on some things. But just as one consideration is filing for personal bankruptcy when you're unemployed is not the best time to file. If I'm a bankruptcy attorney, I've been practicing bankruptcy for 30 years, and I would suggest that if you were going to be filing bankruptcy, the better time to file would be when you're back on your feet with a job, because when you're unemployed, you're going to continue incurring debt probably, and it'd be better to take care of all of it in the bankruptcy once you're back on your feet rather than while you're still unemployed, because frankly, you don't know how long you're going to be unemployed. And why would you use that kind of get out of jail card at that time? I would wait. But to answer your question about specifically 2014, so there's a rule called the three-year rule, which is that in order for taxes to be dischargeable in bankruptcy, it has to be more than 3 years from the due date of the return. So a 2014 tax return, the due date would have been April 15th, let's say 2015, in which case the three-year rule would be satisfied after April 15th, 2018, which is only a couple of weeks from now. So you could say, yeah, you could wait a couple of weeks. But if an extension was filed, then that April 15th date becomes October 15th, and you'd have to wait till after October 15th, 2018 in order to discharge 2014 because of the extension on the due date. That doesn't take into consideration the two-year rule and the 180-day rule, and those are important, or the 240-day rule, I'm sorry, and that those are important because it doesn't say whether or not the 2014 return was timely filed, and it also doesn't address the question whether or not there were any audit assessments or other tax assessments after the assessment based on the return. So that's something that you need to deal with the your bankruptcy. Hopefully your bankruptcy attorney understands discharging taxes. If not, then you need another bankruptcy attorney to do a tax dischargeability analysis to determine whether or not the taxes are dischargeable. Because nothing worse than filing a Chapter 7, for instance, only to find out that the taxes you're hoping to discharge aren't dischargeable yet, and you should have waited. But in any case, I wouldn't recommend filing a bankruptcy while you're unemployed. And if you are unemployed, maybe think about filing a request for currently not collectible doing financials and seeing or not whether or not the taxpayer is not collectible. And that status can go as long as 2 years. So that would buy the taxpayer 2 years breathing space.
All right. Thank you very much, Norman, for that. Moving on to our next question. This is from Erica, who's a CPA, also a subscriber, asking, a taxpayer came to me saying that the IRS is auditing not only him, but every client of his former preparer. Have you heard of this? I've only handled a couple audits for my own clients, and in looking at the return, there were some egregious deductions taken. There is no way we can support these deductions. What do you recommend we do?
So first of all, have I heard of this? Yes, it's very common. So if a tax preparer gets the reputation of filing inaccurate returns in order to reduce the tax liability or to give the taxpayer a refund which he doesn't deserve, then they may audit all that tax preparers or accountants' clients. So yeah, this is not unusual. And what do you do? Well, first of all, one problem is that the taxpayer signed the return under penalty of perjury. So there's really, they kind of should have gone over that and kind of caught it, but okay, they didn't. So then I think the only solution is that when the audit becomes final, when there's a notice of deficiency, is not to fight it and let the notice of deficiency become final. The thing you may want to do, though, is there's probably going to be an accuracy-related penalty, which is 20%. The taxpayer may be able to argue that the return was inaccurate because of the preparer's malfeasance and not anything that the taxpayer did, and the taxpayer relied on the preparer to prepare an accurate return. And you might be able to abate the accuracy-related penalty for reasonable cause, which would have been reliance on the tax preparer. But yeah, they're not going to get out of the audit. I wouldn't take it to tax court or an offer doubt as a liability because they do owe the tax. And next time, review your return before you sign it.
All right. Thank you very much, Norman. Moving on to Gabriel. Gabriel's an EA, also a subscriber or member. He says, a taxpayer has unfiled returns for 10-plus years and has been self-employed for most of that time. He worked a couple of jobs where they issued W-2s and now received a letter from the IRS asking to file 15 and 16. Will the IRS be asking for all the delinquent returns? Client has already indicated that records are almost non-existent for that period of time.
So the answer is not necessarily, because there's something called filing enforcement, which is if you make under a certain amount, you don't need to file a return. And the only way that IRS would know that if you made sufficient income to require filing a return is based on W-2s or 1099s that the taxpayer received. So what I would do is I would order wage and income transcripts from the IRS for those years and only be prepared to file returns for the years that show sufficient income to require returns, either based on 1099s or W-2s. So in the meantime, I would just prepare the 15 and 16 that they're asking for, and in order wage and income transcripts for those 2 years and the other years too, because on preparing your 2015 and 16 returns, you want to look at the wage and income transcripts and make sure that you account for all income on the transcripts, either through W-2s or 1099s.
All right, Gabriel, hopefully that helps you there with that client. Moving on to Jeremy is an EA. I understand that when an OIC is submitted, IRS stops collections and installment agreements in place. Does that mean also that if you submit a current tax return resulting in a refund, they will release the refund?
No, part of the agreement and the offer is that they IRS gets to keep any of your refunds for the year that you submitted the offer. So, and I think also for the year that the offer is accepted, which may be the same year or maybe other years. So by filing, submitting an offer in compromise, you're allowing the IRS to keep that year's refund. So no, don't expect it back. But once the offer is accepted, then subsequent years, you will be able to keep the refund.
Okay, moving on to Lynn. Lynn is a CPA, and Lynn is asking, can an individual rent his second residence to his S-Corp for lodging while on business in that city? Then, does he show the rental income expenses on the personal return? Lynn, this particular question should be directed to a CPA to give you the best advice there. And unfortunately, I was not able to get an answer for you because of tax season. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to bank this question, and as soon as I get a response, I'll email you directly. Again, we apologize, but I was not able to free up one of our CPAs to come in on this call and help us with these tax-related questions. So, Lynn, we're going to put a little marker here and make sure that we get back to you on that one. Okay, next one is from Edward. Edward's an EA. And he says, I have a client who has had a large tax deficiency for a long time. We are working on placing his debt into currently non-collectible status. He will likely qualify for an OIC since he doesn't have much. Would you recommend keeping the CNC status and forget about the offer and compromise? If the offer is rejected, what impact will that have on the CNC status?
Well, they're similar, but they're different. And the main difference is that currently non-collectible is exactly that, currently not collectible. It's a temporary status, and it's reviewed every 2 years or less. And the reason is, like, for instance, if you're in currently non-collectible and you file your tax return and the IRS sees that all of a sudden you're making a lot of money, then they're going to kick you out of CNC. If you're in CNC and you're not making much money after 2 years, they're going to request updated financials to determine what your financial situation is presently. Now, the good thing about currently non-collectible is that the collection statute continues to run. So if you have 2 years, let's say, left on collection, and you're currently non-collectible, then you may be able to run out the clock as currently non-collectible. And by the time that they want to review your currently non-collectible status, the statute on collection has expired. In terms of qualifying for an OIC, you're asking if the OIC is rejected, what impact would that have on the CNC status? And the answer is it wouldn't have any. A rejected offer wouldn't affect the currently non-collectible status. It seems like if you qualify for currently non-collectible, you're probably a good candidate for an offer, except if you have equity in property, or there's so much time left in the statute that the offer specialist determines that they're could collect more from you by running out the statute than they will by accepting the offer. But in this example, it says that they've had a large tax sufficiency. I don't know what your definition of large is for a long time. And I don't know what your definition of a long time is. But if it's a long time, then my guess would be that you have a better chance of having the offer accepted, because when they do the comparison, there's less that they could collect in the life of the statute. So yeah, go for the offer, and it won't affect, it shouldn't affect the CNC.
Now, Ed does have a few follow-up questions here to the offer process. He wants to know, if the offer gets rejected, can you resubmit, and how many times can you do that? So one of the things that maybe we can do, Ed, I'll let Norman answer that part of it, but one of the things is it seems like you're unsure whether or not this offer will get accepted or rejected. So you should know, at least feel very strongly, that an offer that you're about to submit will be approved, and I'll let Norman explain why.
Well, if it gets rejected, you can resubmit, but there'd have to be changed circumstances. In other words, you wouldn't want to be submitting the same offer over and over again, because you're going to get the same result. The only time that you would resubmit an offer would be after some time, if there was some change in circumstance that would affect the offer specialist's analysis of the offer. If they lost equity in their property, or if they had a new job that paid less, or if they had some medical, recurring medical expense that was going up in the expense or something. So there'd have to be something in the equation that permanently changed in order to justify resubmitting a new offer. Otherwise, it's just going to be the same result over and over again.
Yes, and what I was referring to was making sure that you have the reason to submit an offer. Keep in mind that our offers, we have a success rate of about 95% of our offers get approved. And it's not by dumb luck. It's because we understand what the IRS is asking for. We understand what type of client qualifies for an offer. And a majority of people will not do the due diligence in researching or understanding the financials of the client or the taxpayer before submitting an offer. So you should know what the monthly disposable income is. You should know what the values of their assets are before you submit that offer and come up. Remember, the offer process is formula driven. So you should have a very good idea before you submit that offer where you're going to land.
You should go online and do the pre-qualifier, and you should also do the 433A OIC and do the calculation and determine what amount the IRS would accept. And we almost always submit lump sum payment as opposed to periodic payment. So look and see what the IRS would accept as a lump sum payment.
All right, so there you go. If you guys are unclear about the offer process and what the IRS looks for, we do have an upcoming event, April 17th, Offers and Compromise and Appeals. I'm sending through the chat box a link to that upcoming event on April 17th that specifically talks about offers and compromise and appeals. Now, Ed, I'm going to answer your last question here, or have Norman answer the last question, which is, if the taxpayer is on an installment agreement that was badly designed by the IRS and approved by the taxpayer, looking at his finances, he will definitely qualify for an offer. Is there any special steps that we have to do, or just the normal OIC process?
No, you're just going to have a little bit bigger hurdle to clear, because they're going to look at the installment agreement, and they're going to say that shows that the taxpayer can make that payment every month, because he is. And they're going to look at the life of the statute and determine, like, if they continued with the installment agreement, how much would they collect over the life of the statute over how much the taxpayer is offering. So one thing we never do is allow a taxpayer to enter into an installment agreement that they're not comfortable with. And we always say that first off is the installment agreement that you're going to end up with is one you're going to be able to live with. Otherwise, they default or they're unhappy or they incur additional tax liability because they can't make their estimated payments and their installment agreement payments both. And so, yeah, a bad installment agreement is bad for everybody, and we don't allow our clients to enter into bad installment agreements.
All right, moving on to Hank. Hank is a CPA, and Hank is asking, my client was self-employed, failed to pay several years income and payroll taxes. He has no assets to speak of, lien is already in place, and he is now an employee. Revenue officer is involved, and she issued a summons to appear at her office. We're not going to go, and I believe client may qualify for currently non-collectible status until we can file an offer. Other than the RO's continued enforced collection activity, are there any dire consequences from simply not showing up?
I really don't recommend that. That's a summons, and if you ignore the summons, they can issue a warrant, and that's an offense. So the thing is, as the taxpayer's representative, if you can answer all the revenue officer's questions, the representative can appear in the taxpayer's place, so the taxpayer doesn't need to necessarily be there, but definitely the representative does. And the representative may appear with the taxpayer, but under no circumstance would I ignore an IRS summons or subpoena and not appear. I'm not sure why you wouldn't appear. If you think that the taxpayer qualifies for currently non-collectible, then bring the proof and establish that to the revenue officer. But yes, are there steps that you would do? Are there any dire consequences for simply not showing up? And it's yes. They can get the IRS counsel to issue a subpoena, and then you're legally required to appear. So, no, that's not good advice.
All right, moving on to Howard. Howard is an attorney, and Howard is asking, can you prove an amount for health care that exceeds the standard, or is the standard for health care the maximum that you cannot exceed when submitting an offer? Does it matter if OIC or installment agreement?
The answer is no. So the out-of-pocket expense for health care is a national standard. And by the way, new national standards were just issued. And it's kind of interesting because if you look at the out-of-pocket healthcare expenses, it's divided into two categories, under 65 and over 65. And the under 65 category, the amount for out-of-pocket healthcare expense went up. And for the under and for the over 65, the amount for out-of-pocket healthcare went down from 2018 from 2017, so I'm not sure why. But what it means is that without any proof and without having to show any documentation whatsoever, everybody automatically qualifies for the national standard for out-of-pocket, whether you're under 65 or over 65. But if your actual health care expenses exceed the national standard, then you need proof. And the IRS will allow whatever your actual out-of-pocket expenses are, no matter how high, if you can prove it. And also that it's a recurring expense, not a one-time thing. So yeah, if you're on very expensive medication or expensive treatment and your out of pocket is high, if you can prove it, they're going to allow it, and that's going to reduce the amount available for an offer or an installment agreement.
All right, Howard, hopefully that helps you there with identifying the differences and being able to use that to your advantage. Moving on to Tracy. Oh, actually, let me add to the standards. Yes, the IRS updated their standards, but they've also updated some of their forms. So before you go and fill out a 433A, a 9465, or even the
433B.
433B.
I think 2848 too.
Yeah, so all of these, check their website because they have updated them. We are working on doing a release to help you guys with that. But in the meantime, go to the IRS.gov site and download the new forms.
The newest forms are dated March 2018.
Got it. All right, Tracy, back to your question. She's asking, can you explain how we can use an OIC doubtless to liability versus an audit reconsideration? I've heard Peter in previous courses go into detail about this, but I missed something.
Okay, so usually in an audit, there's two letters that are issued. The first letter is called the 30-day letter, and it's from the auditor, and it says, here's a draft of the changes that I recommend. And if you disagree with me, then within 30 days, let me know why you disagree. And if you have any additional documentation to support your position, then provide me with that documentation. So if you either don't respond to the 30-day letter or respond and the auditor determines that whatever you said or showed her or him isn't going to change their mind, then they'll issue the notice of deficiency. And the notice of deficiency is sometimes called the 90-day letter because the notice of deficiency gives the taxpayer 90 days to file a petition in U.S. tax court if they disagree with the examination changes. Now, sometimes what happens is a client comes to you and the 90-day letter, the 90 days have passed. So now the tax court no longer has jurisdiction to hear the protest. And the 90 days have passed at the tax court. It's not that they won't, it's that they can't. They don't have the jurisdiction to hear the case. So what do you do? And the answer is you can do an offer doubtless a liability. So for instance, if there were expenses that were disallowed because you didn't have proper documentation and now you do, you could submit an offer doubtless a liability and provide the additional documentation and you can get another bite of the apple that way and argue that the examination changes were wrong. Just keep in mind that an offer doubt is the liability. Number one, it doesn't have a filing fee like offer doubt is the collectability does. And number two is it doesn't require a down payment like a offer doubt is to collectability does. But an offer doubt as to liability does require that the taxpayer acknowledge that there is some liability. They can't say that there's no liability and they owe nothing or that they deserve a refund. So that if you're going to do as a doubt as to liability, then if you can prove some of the expenses but not all, then you would say that you shouldn't be liable for the expenses that you can prove and the expenses that you still can't prove you'll accept because you can't prove that those. So that's how doubt is a liability works. It gives you another opportunity to dispute an audit even though the time to file a tax court petition or object to the auditor has passed.
All right, Tracy, hopefully that helps you. And one of the things that I want to reiterate here is that sometimes you're just not aware of the tools that you have available to help you with any particular tax client. And this is the perfect example. What if you never heard about offers and compromise doubt as to liability? What if you only knew that there was one available? Did you know that there's a third option for effective tax administration? You know, all these things, unless you have the right people guiding you and showing you what is available to you, you may not even be aware of it. So perfect time to for me to talk about the VIP membership. Use consultation time with our professionals to be able to address these issues. Any questions regarding a particular case, whether it be tax resolution related or tax related, we can put you in contact with our attorneys, with our CPAs, and those people who specialize in this area. We are offering a two-month free trial. I'm going to go ahead and send a link now for this free trial. But you know what? It's a perfect time to sign up because we do have that April 17th event coming up. And if you are a VIP member, you get to attend that for free. The course is $99 without a membership. But go ahead and sign up for this trial. You don't have to pay anything for the trial. It is a two-month free trial. And you get to be able to attend the April 17th course at no additional cost. Do one before the other, though. You got to do the trial first and then sign up for the course so you can get that perfect opportunity to sign up for two things here. Get the biggest bang for your notebook because you don't have to pay anything.
So I'd just like to say that that offer effective administration is very rare. Most offers are doubt as to collectability. A few are doubt as to liability. An effective tax administration is very, very rare. It's a situation where a regular offer wouldn't work because, for instance, the taxpayer has equity in their home, or they may even own their home free and clear. But the argument would be due to the taxpayer's health and or age that they need to be able to live rent-free in their home, because they couldn't afford to live anywhere else. So we're in a normal offer. They would, and the taxpayer had a home free and clear. They would tell them to sell the house and pay the IRS from the equity. But if they couldn't afford to live anywhere else, then the IRS would allow them to remain in the home because of their age or health. And then the offer would be based only on their disposable income.
Thank you, Norman. Yes, that was to clarify effective tax administration. But moving on, I pushed the link, guys, so go ahead and sign up, and you'll be able to attend the course coming up on April 17th. Okay, next question is from Tisha. Tisha's a CPA. And she's asking, what is a typical timeline for getting a lien removed? I've never done a lien release and would like to know the general procedure.
Okay, so lien releases, they usually ask that you give them 30 days. So I'm not sure if this lien is being released because tax was paid off or because the statute for collection is expired and the lien is expired. So because otherwise it's self-releasing, which means it releases automatically when the collection statute expires. As to a lien release after the tax has been paid in full, usually 30 days. If you need it early, you can call what's called the advisory group. It used to be called the lien desk. And you can ask them to expedite it if you need it, if you need the release quicker for some reason or other.
All right, moving on to Eric. Eric is asking, can the trust fund taxes be discharged in bankruptcy?
So the answer, unfortunately, is no, because a trust fund recovery penalty is in terms of a bankruptcy claims, it's a priority, and priority claims aren't discharged. So in a Chapter 7, it would survive the Chapter 7. In a Chapter 13, it would be a priority claim, and so it would have to be paid in full. So what you could do is file a Chapter 13, but you'd have to have a sufficient disposable income to have a plan payment that would pay the trust fund liability in full within the 5 years of the plan.
Got it. And yeah, just did you explain, sorry, I was responding to a question here online. Did you explain what the trust fund is?
So the trust fund is when an employer withholds taxes from the employee and then matches them for the 941. It's the trust fund portion is the portion that was withheld from the employee's paycheck and should have been paid to the IRS, but wasn't. And so the IRS assessed that trust fund portion, not only to the company, the employer, but also to a responsible person, somebody who made the decision to take the money out of the employee's pay, but not pay it to the IRS. So that person is now personally responsible for the trust fund portion of the payroll tax and cannot discharge that in bankruptcy.
All right. Thank you, Norman. I am getting down to the last couple of questions here submitted online, previously by email. So I will be opening it up to the rest of you online here shortly. So if you have a question related to tax resolution, please go ahead and submit them now in your questions box, or simply give me your name and I will make you live so that you can ask the group on the call. Okay, so before I do that, but go ahead and submit those now. Moving on to the next one then is going to be James. James is asking, my client was just awarded CNC status for several years but has not filed for 2017 yet. It looks like they are going to owe for 2017 too. What impact will that have on the CNC status, and will they leave them alone since they already approved CNC?
Yeah, so 2017 won't be included in the currently non-collectible status, and so will be collectible. So they could levy the taxpayer either through a wage levy or bank levy to pay 2017 unless they call and try to get 2017 into currently non-collectible as well. But if when they were put in currently non-collectible, they probably submitted a 433F, and there's some, if they owe for 17, then there's a withholding problem. Either it's under withholding for their W-2, in which case they need to do a W-4 to increase their withholding. Or if they're 1099, then they're not making their estimated payments. And so before they're going to put 2017 into the currently non-collectible too, then the taxpayer needs to get into compliance for 2018 and either increase their withholding or make their estimated payments.
Right, and this is something Norman is always asked us about here on the tax resolution, is what's going on with the current taxes, in this particular case 2017. Before we go down that road of setting up an installment agreement or CNC status or submitting an offer, we need to know what's going to happen with the current tax year. So it's important that you ask the very same question. Are they going to owe? If so, will they be able to pay it all off when the taxes are due? If not, then hurry up and get it done so we can roll it in with whatever we're doing for them. Okay, moving on to the last question here from Roger. Again, I am opening it up for the rest of you online. If you have a question, please go ahead and submit those now. I am now doing the last question here from the people submitted prior to the call. So Roger's asking, how long after the statute of limitation expires on collection can the IRS collect from a lien? Can you force the IRS to cancel a lien after the statute of limitation expires on collections? Or at their discretion, can they keep the lien until the property is sold?
Okay. The lien normally expires the same time that the collection statute does. So once the collection statute expires and the tax is no longer collectible, the lien is no longer valid, because the lien is only there to secure payment. But once the tax is no longer owed or collectible, then there's no reason for the lien. So the lien expires with this collection statute. The only time the lien is extended is when the collection statute is extended, because it was told, either for time being in an offer or appeal period or a pending installment agreement. So, and that only extends the lien to the extent that the collection statute is extended. So in any case, the lien does not extend beyond the collection statute, whether that statute has been extended or not. So, and that's automatic. Liens are self-releasing, and they release automatically. If they're extended, the extension is for 10 years, but the IRS is supposed to go in and manually release that lien once the collection statute has expired. They're supposed to do that within 30 days.
And just a follow-up question here from online. This is from Thomas. Thomas is asking, on that particular situation you just spoke about, Norman, how would a reverse mortgage play in with this issue? Do you know?
I don't know. I've never had that question. Frankly, I'm sorry, but I don't know.
And does a lien automatically expire and remove, or does the IRS need to file the cancellation? So I think you answered that. Yeah. Okay, next one here. Looks like, Freddie, you're online and you're asking, is it correct that if a taxpayer's 10-year statute expires in 1 year and they just entered into an installment agreement, that they will only end up making payments for the remaining year? If I understand this, it is a partial payment installment agreement.
That's correct, but usually the IRS won't enter into an installment agreement if there's only like a year left on the statute. They want to try to have the taxpayer pay it off within the statute. But if the statute expires in a year, then the installment agreement expires at the same time that the statute on collection expires. And they should get a letter from the IRS saying that it's no longer collectible, and that they're not required to make installment payments any longer, but if they want to make voluntary payments, they can. But I don't know why they would.
Okay, Emerson is asking, client ignored notices from IRS on an old company he had and since stopped operating. His personal bank account was levied to the tune of $25,000. Under what circumstances will the IRS return the levied money if the liability was for the company?
Well, first of all, we don't know what liability it was. Is it a C corp? Is it an S corp? Was it for income taxes? Was it for payroll taxes? And and on the personal bank account, was the old company a sole proprietorship? Did it have an EIN number, or was it using the taxpayer social security number? So, I mean, there's lots of questions that I can't answer with the information I have. But if the company had its own EIN, it shouldn't be going after.
He said it was payroll tax, and it was an S corporation. He's responding online.
Oh, okay. So if it was payroll tax, then the taxpayer may have some trust fund exposure, and they may have been levying for the trust fund. But That may be it.
Yeah, it sounds like it is a trust fund issue, and he may or may not have been aware that they personally assessed them, especially if it's a little older corporation. All right, the next question.
I mean, if you have a question, call the IRS and ask them.
Yeah.
Because the bank, on a bank levy, the bank's going to hold the money for 21 days. So if it's not too late, as soon as you find out, contact the IRS. And if they made a mistake, they can fax or release to the bank, and the bank can unfreeze the money, because it's a lot easier to get the money back while the bank's holding it frozen rather than waiting till the bank sends the money to the IRS and then trying to get the money back from the IRS. So I would call right away just to make sure. It's not too late. If the bank's still holding the money, it's very easy for the IRS to fax a release to the bank and have the bank unfreeze the money.
Okay, Martin online is asking, this is a bankruptcy question, Norman. If a client in bankruptcy owes for 2017 and does not have the funds to pay because their payments are set currently, I think, Martin, if you can clarify, are you talking about Chapter 7 or 11?
Or 13.
Or
13. And the thing is, if it's a 13, the IRS can file what's called an administrative claim, which is a priority claim, and that has to be paid in the bankruptcy, or the bankruptcy won't get a discharge, or the IRS could file a motion to dismiss the bankruptcy because the taxpayer is incurred post-petition tax liability. If it's a 7, it shouldn't really affect it because the tax isn't going to be discharged anyways. And so they can continue with this, getting the discharge in the 7. But if it's a 13, it could create problems where either the plan becomes infeasible because of the additional administrative claim filed, or the IRS could file a motion to dismiss the case because of the post-petition tax liability. So, yeah, a 13 could be an issue. A 7, it shouldn't be.
Got it. Martin just responded saying the attorney says to send a tax form, and then they can amend the payments to the payers. I guess he's referring to submitting the form to court so they can amend the bankruptcy.
But what chapter?
He didn't specify. No. Okay, moving on here to another question from Marshall. Marshall's asking, can you speak on the differences between a California state offering compromise versus an IRS offering compromise? What can I expect of the taxpayer owes for both agencies?
So the IRS is much more formula driven, where if you do the 433A OIC and you do the calculation at the end, it will tell you exactly what your offer should be, where the FTB, which is California, doesn't, you go through the offer form and it doesn't do a calculation. It just asks you at the end, what's your offer? And so you kind of have to know what the FTB will accept. And what it is usually like 5 or 6 years disposable income. So you'd have to look at the disposable income for the FTB and like multiply that by 60 or something and come up with a number that they will accept as an offer. Because remember, the state has 20 years to collect. So they're really looking much longer term than the IRS, which only has 10 years to collect. So an FTB offer in that sense is kind of more difficult to get accepted. And also the FTB has something called administrative costs, which they want reimbursed, and that is that the FTB sends its out for collection, they have collection costs that they want paid. Sometimes the FTB will only accept an offer that pays the tax liability and will forgive the penalties and interest, but they want the tax paid. So FTB offer is much more difficult, and it's not formula driven like the IRS. And so you should pretty much expect to pay 60 months disposable income to an FTB offer.
All right. Not to mention FTB also has 20 years to collect.
Yeah.
So that's what makes it a little more difficult as well. Looks like this is going to be the last question from the members online. This is coming from Shakarat, and he's talking about an audit. So client had an exam that resulted in increased tax assessment. The examiner received a corrected P&L with increase in income. However, looks like the examiner ignored the increased expenses and supporting bank statements. Taxpayer signed the increase in tax without knowing what they were signing. Should I do an audit reconsideration or an offering compromise doubt as to liability?
Okay, so if what I understand is correctly is they signed like a waiver acknowledging and agreeing to the tax increase, I think they're kind of stuck with it.
So what he's saying is that the examiner ignored the expenses, even though they provided a corrected P&L.
Right, but then
this is an IRS audit.
Okay, so then there was a notice of deficiency. There was a 90-day period to file a tax court petition. Now, usually what you do or what we recommend taxpayers to do, even if they agree, is do nothing. Why sign it? It's just going to make the assessment quicker, and you're going to, unless there's some reason, either for because there's going to be a bankruptcy in the future or some other reason, I'm not sure why you would want to hasten the assessment of the tax. And so usually even with trust fund recovery penalties on the proposal is don't sign it and just let the tax become final on its own or appeal it within the appeal period. But even if you're not going to appeal it, you should just let the tax become final on its own, because then you could always do a doubt as to liability claim, but not if you signed off on it.
Yeah, so I guess it depends on what it exactly was that he signed, because there is that that when the 30-day letter is issued, you can bypass the 90-day or sorry, not the no, you can bypass the 90-day waiting period when the notice of deficiency is issued.
You could just sign.
You can sign, and they'll assess it then.
Right. So you're signing, acknowledging it, and right. And you pretty much signed away your appeal rights.
So does it sound like this taxpayer is kind of stuck?
If that's what it was, yeah.
All right, Shakarat, if you want us to review it a little more carefully, feel free to sign up for the membership. We'll review the documentation and give you some additional guidance. But that's going to do it for this month, guys. Thank you very much for attending. Don't forget the links. I'm going to leave them up on the chat box here for a few more minutes after the event. We do have an upcoming course, April 17th, on offers and compromise and appeals. You can attend for free if you sign up for a two-month free trial of our membership services. So again, nothing but free offers being offered here by TRI. So thank you very much. A couple more weeks for the end of the tax season. Hope it all goes well and you guys are enjoying and having a good time. But thank you again, and we'll see you again on May 1st.